Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. The underlying suit in this case is a suit in which there are rival claims to title to property, to real property. Plaintiffs originally, the appellants, originally filed suit declaring that deeds that were conveyed in their name, conveying their property, were forged deeds, and that, of course, as the court knows, forged deeds can never pass interest and title to property. Eventually, apparently, the property was conveyed to the intervener, the appellant in this case, and he intervened, and he did claim title to the property, and in the alternative, he claimed reimbursement for improvements made to the property. In the trial court, the judge found that the deeds were, in fact, forged and invalid, that title remained with the appellants, but she awarded the intervener, the appellant here, $14,500 for money he allegedly spent improving the property. The problem with that argument is, first of all, I believe that this is, in fact, a claim for trespass to try title to suit, and there is longstanding Texas Supreme Court case law that says that any suit that adjudicates title to land is, in fact, a trespass to try title suit. And additionally, that as long as the pleadings substantially comply with Rule 783, that they will be found to be trespass to try title. And I believe that the plaintiff's petition does substantially comply. It names the plaintiffs, it names the defendants, it says that the plaintiff's interest is a fee simple, that they are the owners, that they did not convey the property, that it was they were entitled to it, and they were wrongfully dispossessed of it. They asked the trial court to declare their title clear and that those deeds were invalid.
But the intervener claims that he's not says that he's not claiming title, and that he wants restitution. Based on unjust enrichment. So does that make a difference that there's not, as between the plaintiff and the intervener, a dispute as to title?
I think that there's two answers to that. I think it doesn't make a difference whether he claimed title or not, because of the case law says that any improvement for a claim for improvement on title to property or improvements done on another property is governed by a law that says, if it's not the property code, it's case law and equity that says that that improver would be entitled to the value, the difference in the value of the property, the amount you increase the value of the property, not a dollar-for-dollar contribution. But in addition to that, in his plea and intervention, which is in the record, he says, he states, the intervener requests the court to enter its order declaring that intervener has title to and plaintiffs are divested of title to that property. So he did claim title to it. And then he says in the alternative, he claims his improvements. Under the property code, it is his burden, the intervener, to plead and prove that he made valuable and permanent improvements and that those improvements increased the value of the property, and that he would be entitled to that increase in value of the property. Even if the court didn't find that this was a trespass to try title suit and the property code didn't apply, there's longstanding Supreme Court law from the state of Texas all the way back to actually 1918, 1911, 1891 that says even in a suit for an equity claim, the improver of the property must secure a finding on the increase of the value of the property. And it's a well-established principle in equity that if they, to be entitled to that compensation, they have to show the enhancement in value. And it's his burden to plead it and prove it. And it is not the original cost of the improvements. And Sharp v. Stacy, the Texas Supreme Court, specifically says it is not the original cost of improvements, but the enhancement in value of land by reason of the improvements. Since the intervener failed to secure that finding, he's precluded from recovering any compensation for those improvements. If you look in the record, which is not very long, it's just a few pages on his testimony, and even in his brief, he admits what what he started to do was he cut the grass, he hauled off trash, he started some work on it. That is not, cutting grass and hauling off trash is not a valuable and permanent improvement. Adding a structure, replacing the roof, something like that is a valuable and permanent improvement, not hauling away trash or cleaning up debris. He, in his exhibits that he admitted to the trial court, in there, there's no evidence as to the value of the property before these alleged improvements were made. There's no evidence or testimony or exhibits. There's nothing to show the value of the property after the improvements were made. There's nothing that the trial court could have properly rendered judgment on. He made a bare allegation with no evidence saying, I spent this much money. Not that I've improved the value of the property, but I spent this much money. And furthermore, it was a bare allegation. He provided no receipts. He provided no canceled checks. He provided nothing other than a bare allegation to the court. I spent this money. Even if he did, he's not entitled to it.
After he intervened, did your clients file any claim back against him?
No, they did not, because I believe that it doesn't matter. I don't think they would have to go and file under, you know, each person in that chain of title, because once that deed was declared void because it was a forgery, from the beginning, it could never pass any interest. So anyone subsequent in that chain could never acquire any interest in that title. And, you know, if you were a good faith improver of that property, that's your burden to come forward and say, wait a minute, I improved this property, and here's my proof, and here's how much I improved it by. It's not, it wasn't the appellant's burden to settle a claim with this man. It was his burden to bring it forward. He had to plead it, and to plead it, he has to bring that forward. But he produced absolutely no evidence, and that was my main reason for submitting all of his exhibits, is not to show you what they are, but to show you what they aren't. They're, all the exhibits are those, all those subsequent forged deeds and a proposal, not even a contract or receipt, a proposal from someone to do some work, and which was never finished. And in fact, the property wasn't improved. The property actually was damaged and is in worse condition than when the intervener took the property. He actually tore things out of the house, and there is no improvement to it in reality.
Ms. Bonilla.
Yes, sir.
So there's no evidence in that. I read the transcript in the trial court. There was testimony that was presented by Mr. Allen that was heard by the trial judge in verbal testimony. There wasn't any documents other than the proposed contracts that you're talking about, but we could look at the judge's findings in the lower court after having that verbal testimony that there was evidence about the $14,500 that was awarded in the judgment.
Well, I guess you could consider that evidence, and I guess that would go to the weight or the credibility of it, but I believe it's insufficient and is not sufficient to maintain this judgment. And even if he did produce documents and receipts and witnesses proving beyond all question, yes, I did spend this money, which I don't believe to be the case, but even if he did, I don't think it would matter, because the law, longstanding case law, says that even under trespass to try title suit, the property code, section 22, lays out those specific requirements, and these equity cases lay out the same requirements. The equity cases that I cite, Sharp v. Stacy, Burton v. Bell, and DeCon versus DeCon, you know, those were not trespass to try title suits. They were just claims where, in one case, Sharp v. Stacy, they tried to take an oral agreement for transfer of title out of the statute of frauds, and the transferee had improved the land. He failed to meet that burden by proving that he made the valuable and permanent improvements and by how much it increased the value of the land. He submitted that he spent $10,000 doing it, but the court ruled that that's not the burden that you were supposed to meet, therefore you cannot recover. And those suits were in equity and had nothing to do with trespass to tri-title. And Texas has long held the entire century that those standards apply, that they must be valuable and permanent. The improver would be entitled to the difference in value, the increase in the value, not a dollar for dollar increase. So I think that would, that point wouldn't, it wouldn't bear on this anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonilla. Mr. Burkett?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Before I get into argument of the law or dealing with the facts in this case, I've got to address the issue of whether this court can consider the appeal as presented by the appellants at all. The appellants have failed to abide by not only the rules of appellate procedure, but have failed to abide by this court's own written statements by failing to timely file a reporter's record in this case. The trial court reporter gave notice that she had not been contacted to file or prepare a reporter's record. This court gave notice that there had not been a reporter's record filed, and in writing gave notice of the consequence of the failure to file it within the deadline set in this court's own letters. That deadline came and went. Nothing was filed. Almost 3 weeks later, still nothing had been filed. This court sent out a letter to all parties saying that because of the failure to file, the only issues that the court was going to address are those that do not require reference to the reporter's record. I've attached those letters to my brief, and they're available to you. Everything raised by the appellants in this case require reference to the reporter's record. If we take your statements as being binding in this matter, then we do not have a reporter's record on file. And this court has to presume that the trial court's judgment is supported by sufficient proof and testimony, and the appellant's appeal has to fail as presented to you. Getting into the appeal itself, though, I would point out a few things that are misstatements of fact as presented to you by the appellants, primarily the one that was argued to you pretty heavily, and that is that there's no proof that Nathaniel Allen gave the court testimony or proof otherwise as to the monies he spent on this property, and that's simply not the case. I believe, as Justice Myers pointed out, it is in the record. He did testify to it. There are exhibits in the record to which reference can be made. Those support the trial court's finding that he did, in fact, spend money and that he did, in fact, spend $14,500. They claim that Mr. Allen never offered proof that any of the work he did or the money he spent benefited the property, and that's simply not the case either. He specifically testified that it did. And again, it's in the reporter's record if you choose to look at it. As to the question that was asked about did you sue Mr. Allen, they did not. And the record will show from the appellant's own testimony, they knew Mr. Allen, and actually a person prior before him, had taken record title of this property more than a year before the trial of this case. But they never sued him. Ms. Bonilla's response was, well, you don't need to because we just sued the folks who got the deeds that we claim were void, and that takes care of the title question. Well, that's simply another example of why this is not a trespass to try title case. you can't deal in the trespass or title determination with people that are way down the early in the chain of title without dealing with the folks who are record owners, current record owners.
But didn't the intervener file a claim to title as his first cause of action and then only alternatively for reimbursement?
Now, if you look, you'll see that the first paragraph in his pleading say that he is bringing this to assert a claim against, at that time, the plaintiffs, that claim being the unjust enrichment and, at the time, equitable subordination. Later in the pleading, you will see specific language that says that the intervener, Mr. Allen, doesn't contest or affirm the allegations of the plaintiffs, simply that he's putting the trial court on notice that he's the current record owner. If the plaintiffs can prove their case, then that's fine. But he did not contest at any time their claims as to fraud that occurred to them or whether those the deeds in question, the early deeds, should be set aside. He took a neutral position. He never asserted title. He simply said, I am the current record owner. And during the trial offered proof, of course, that he is. But he never contested those claims in his pleadings or at trial. Before I get into that, let's talk a little bit more about whether this was a trespass case. And in addition, which to me is the most important thing, that they didn't sue the folks who were the record owners. In addition, their pleadings really don't follow Rule 783. Now, admittedly, 783 is a throwback to the more old formal pleading days, but nonetheless, it's there, and you need to put that in there to tell people, to tell folks that this is a trespass case. And you put those formal pleadings in there. They're not there. They are simply not there. And the very next rule, 784, says that at the very least, the defendant, the entity or person to be made a defendant in a trespass case is the record owner or the current possessor of the property, which, of course, never happened. They never sued Mr. Allen. They never used the words trespass to try title. They never put in their pleadings, please, court, provide us a determination of title and declare the title to be in us. And again, they knew that Mr. Allen, by their own testimony, possessed the property and had a deed to the property at least a year before trial. And they never did anything about it. You can't recover on a cause of action that you don't assert. Quite frankly, you've got to put people on notice of what you want. In their prayer for relief, all they said is, we want fraud relief. We want these deeds voided, and we want exemplary damages for fraud. And that's all they asked for. I quoted one case in my brief where basically a court said that in the prayer, even though the plaintiffs at the time said this is a trespass to try title case, all they said in their prayer was, we want injunctive relief. And the court in that case said, well, no, and that kind of prayer doesn't support trespass relief. Equally so, a prayer for fraud relief isn't going to support trespass relief. They went to trial only on their original petition against the original defendants, Beasley and U.S. affiliates, and again, if you'll look at the judgment doesn't use trespass to try title relief anywhere. It just grants fraud relief, and that's all. In addition, of course, to the reimbursement to Mr. Allen under his unjust enrichment. But they simply didn't plead or present to the court a trespass to try title case. Appellants argue that even if it's not a trespass case, still, the measure of damages needs to be market value increase or decrease depending on what was spent. The cases cited by the appellants in their brief, however, are only divorce and probate cases. And in both those, it's pretty clear that you do deal with market value. They're not, quote, equity cases. They're probate and divorce cases, or apply a probate and divorce law. Unjust enrichment is an equitable cause of action, and it's applicable here. Unjust enrichment exists to basically restore someone to a position they occupied because of detriment to them based on inequitable conduct by another party. And let's look at what the plaintiffs in this case could have done that would have spared Mr. Allen or his predecessor entitled spending any money on this property, but they didn't do it. First, and again, this is all by their own testimony, they had not occupied that property since the year 2000. And remember that Mr. Allen got his deed in 2007. The property was sitting there vacant, no possession, no nothing, and in fact, if you believe some of the testimony, it was actually vacant longer than that. They didn't pay taxes. There were delinquent taxes against that property. At least as important as any of their other failures, they never filed a notice of lease pendants in the deed records after they filed this suit. They filed the suit in 2005. We didn't get to trial until 2009. They let the case languish there for 4 years. And in that intervening 4 years, record ownership passed twice. It never would have happened if they'd simply filed a lease pendants, but they didn't do it.
And were there any claims asserted against the two other parties that were in the chain of title?
No, ma'am. No. Well, all they went to trial on were their original pleadings against the original two defendants. Basically, this is the classic case for unjust enrichment. The appellants could have done something to prevent it, and it didn't happen. And I'd submit to you that in situations like that, if a party can prove it, then unjust enrichment is an alternative action to simply the claim for reimbursement under trespass to try title rules anyway. It's tough to prove, but if you can prove it, equity steps in and says this isn't right. And that's exactly what's here, and equally important is that was a finding by the trial court that has not been contested on this appeal by the appellants. Now, once you reach this stage, you say, all right, what is the measure of damages for unjust enrichment? That's pretty clear. It's just sort of black-letter law. Unjust enrichment doctrine focuses on reimbursement to the person who was harmed. It doesn't focus on value. It doesn't focus on what the other parties may have received. It does focus and does look to see if any benefit occurred, which the trial court found did, and if benefit occurred, what was spent. And that amount is to be reimbursed under unjust enrichment rules. It's about that simple. We would, therefore, submit to the court that the trial court judgment should be affirmed as it stands now and go forward with the matter. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Burke,
yes, sir.
The position you took relative to the filing of the reporter's record, we're admonished in the appellate rules at 35.3 subsection C to bend over backwards to be careful that all the record on appeal gets properly filed, both the trial court's responsibility and the appellate court's. And in the circumstances of what occurred here, there was notice on December 17th that there hadn't been a reporter's record filed, but then there was, in fact, a reporter's record filed in advance of the date of, first date of submission, which the reporter's record was filed on January the 14th.
Yes, sir.
And in
I
terms
agree.
Of what we're doing here in the appellate court, we're trying to be careful everyone gets their day in front of the court with all the records in front of the court. There wasn't anything filed on your part that would have required court, this court, to look only at the records of the status of the record before that reporter's record was filed. In other words, you didn't seek an affirmative order of a court that we should limit the points on appeal to only those matters not that were capable of being looked at without the reporter's record.
I understand, Your Honor, and I understand that it's certainly in your prerogative to accept the case and accept the reporter's record as presented. It just, I didn't see that it was my responsibility to get the record filed, nor did I see it as my responsibility to ask the court to modify its earlier statements that you weren't going to look at the record.
Well, that was
and
the record.
That's
that,
fine.
That statement was in the letter from the clerk that was talking about the
I understand.
Date.
But there was no request to modify that.
Yeah, it wasn't an order of the court in terms of anything that this court had ordered. But in fact, you actually make use of the record very well in the cites you make in your brief.
Well, so. I can't ignore it, Judge.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Burkett. Ms. Bonilla, rebuttal?
Yes, ma'am.
I have to apologize to the court for the late filing of the record. What I did was, after I filed notice of appeal in, I think it was October 7th, October 28th, I requested the clerk's record and paid the fee. I got a letter from the clerk asking for the reporter's record. I made an error, as we all do at times, and I filed a second request for the clerk's record again, as opposed to the reporter's record. So I, in fact, filed a request for two clerk's records rather than the clerk and the reporter's record. As soon as the clerk notified me of what I had done, I immediately contacted the court reporter, filed the, paid the fee, and filed the record. So I apologize for the mistake. And, you know, as you pointed out, Rule 34 does require, you know, the appellate court cannot refuse to file a reporter's record because of a failure timely request to file it under 34.6b3. And, you know, it is your discretion to accept it. And as far as on the plaintiff's original petition, I believe that the case law says the petition does not have to exactly track 783. The case law says that as long as it substantially complies, and I believe it does, you know, they lay out that they're the plaintiffs, and at the time they filed this suit, they had a they've had more than one attorney on this. Those defendants had been in possession of it. The people that were subsequent in the chain of title were all found to be fictitious people and fictitious entities that couldn't be located. They claim that they are the record owners of the tract, when it was conveyed to them and how, that they were owners in fee simple, that a forged deed was conveyed, and I think that gives notice what they're claiming, that this is our property. And in their prayer, you know, I know we do have liberal pleading rules, and they ask that it be removed from the title to the plaintiff's property. I think that's saying we want our property declared ours free and clear. So I think there definitely is notice to that. And as to the argument of unjust enrichment, that is an argument that sounds in contract. And in fact, the appellee even refers to you in his brief, Corbin on contracts. And he refers many times to contract relief. And he almost said it. He said detrimental. The other word is reliance, detrimental reliance. They didn't rely on anything that the appellants did because they had no contact with the appellants. There was no contract. There was no implied contract. There can't be quantum merit, quasi-contract, because the appellants didn't have any contact with the intervener. They didn't entice him or have him rely on, yeah, we'll pay you for doing this work. There was never any contact. So there can't be a contract there. There can't be that kind of relief. That just sounds in contract, and there was never any interaction between the two. There cannot possibly be a contract, and unjust enrichment is not just some relief that you can, oh, I don't like the property code and I don't like the case law, so let's go with this contract relief. There was none. There is an equitable remedy, And Texas Supreme Court case law says that in order to claim this equitable remedy for the reimbursement, these are the things you prove: the valuable and permanent improvements, the increase in the value to the property. There was no contract. That argument fails as a matter of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bonilla.
Thank you.
Mr. Burkett, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing today. Your case is submitted. We have a third case on our docket, but we'll take a 10-minute recess to allow you time to set up and to give us a quick little break.